The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Republicans in the United States House of Representatives haven't always gotten along over the past couple of years. But Missouri Congresswoman Ann Wagner says she's been able to deliver for the state's 2nd congressional district despite the GOP infighting. On the latest episode of Politically Speaking, Wagner explains why voters in the suburban St. Louis district should keep her in office another 2 years. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. I am thrilled that there are now two second district residents in the studio today. One is me, and the other is the person that actually represents the second congressional district.
Ann Wagner.
So you are running again. The second district changed 2 years ago. We talked extensively about the redistricting changes. We're not going to go down that rabbit hole. Why continue in this Congress, which has become kind of notorious for not being able to get a lot of things done and being very fractious even within your own caucus?
Well, I'm running because I want to make sure that Missourians, their lives are better, easier, certainly more affordable. And I've made it my mission, Jason, to make sure our government is responsive to working for our constituents. And I'm fighting every single day to win this election and continue my record of service and accomplishments. And there are ways to get things done in divided government. I do reach across the aisle. I believe that I am part of the governing portion of this House. And I mean, I'm thrilled. I was looking back over some of the 118th Congress records here, and our accomplishments are very, very strong, to be perfectly honest. I've got 8 bills that have been signed into law so far in the 18th Congress. And they're important bills, like the Debbie Smith Act, which actually funded the backlog of rape kits across this country, which is abhorrent to think that a woman who has been raped and then puts herself through the rape kit testing, that it would sit on a shelf at a crime lab and for years and not be tested. So we got that fully funded. That was a big accomplishment we were able to get signed into law. But even things like the Fly Together Act I've worked on for several years that allows children to fly in an airplane and sit next to their parents and or grandparents without paying hundreds of dollars extra for that seat.
I'm shocked that that was even a thing that needed to be legislated.
I witnessed it myself as I moved to other seats just to allow a crying mother or 2-year-old to sit next to her child. And I couldn't believe, and then they would tell me, this was several years ago, they'd have to pay an extra $150, $200 just to have their child sit next to them. So Fly Together was signed into law. I'm thrilled about that. A lot of great pieces of legislation on child exploitation and sex trafficking that is still a passion of mine. And certainly in the foreign affairs arena, dealing with the Abraham Accords, which is obviously the accords that President Trump did between the Arab nations and Israel and the U.S., back during his time that is important now more than ever, as we have the war in the Middle East going on, and certainly between Hamas and Israel and the rest of Iran and their proxies. So very important pieces of legislation. But I also have 12 pieces of legislation that have passed the floor, and I'm waiting for the Senate to pass. And I think a number of them are going to make it through, Jason. I really do. And many of those are in the financial services sector.
Which is, you've been a member of the financial services and also the Foreign Affairs Committee for a long time.
Correct. I've served and now am the chairman of the Capital Markets Subcommittee, which I believe is financial services. I believe it is capitalism. I believe it is America. And so I've got a number of great bills that help public offerings and the retail investors save for the future, which is getting much more difficult, giving them opportunities. Things are going to stop seniors from being bilked, especially through AI and such. So we've got a number of 12 that I'm hoping to still pass, 8 laws. But probably one of the things that I'm most proud of, and it doesn't get enough coverage, is what we're able to do for the region in terms of national defense and our security. And I have supported the National Defense Authorization and our appropriation amendments and in the House. And the St. Louis area, thanks to, I have carried all of them for this region, and it spreads across the district, into the exurbs, into St. Charles.
Primarily because Cori Bush has not supported a lot of things related to Boeing and things like that.
That would be correct. So it was up to me this time. And the area, St. Louis region, and it's, I'd say, the defense industrial base along with Boeing, will receive $235 million for T-7 aircrafts built here in our community, $2 billion for our F-15s and the JDAMs that are produced out in St. Charles, at the MQ-25s. I got $6 million for advanced armor production development in St. Louis. So especially with the world that is on fire, wars in the Middle East, wars in Europe, replenishing and rebuilding our defense industrial base, that is a big part of not just our national security and common defense, but an economic driver of the area. So those have been key accomplishments that I've been able to get done. We've got, you know, some big things that obviously the House has passed, but Senator Schumer has not been willing to put on the floor. For instance, H.R. 1, our lower energy costs. We are living for the day when we can release all of our potential in liquid natural gas, LNG. I call us the Saudi Arabia of LNG, and fracking is going to be key, and we want that back. They have cut off the fracking, cut off the permits, won't let folks drill, will not let us expand our energy base, and not only would it give us energy independence, it would allow us to export this to Europe. So they're not looking to Russia and the East. And it'd be a lot cleaner, I'll also say, and cheaper. So those kinds of things. The Secure the Border Act, which was very, very important to us. We know what's happening now with the fentanyl and the human trafficking. And we can talk about immigration.
We will talk about that later in the show.
And
the
SAVE Act, you know, that was something we passed twice in the House. We're just trying to make sure that that only American citizens can vote in our elections. Jason, that is important, and that is what is in our Constitution. And people say, oh, it doesn't happen. Well, yes, it does.
I will say there are non-citizens who do register to vote, and oftentimes they do it because they think that they have to. If they come from a place in South America where voting is compulsory, they may register thinking that it's okay when it's not. That could actually make it so they can't get a legal immigration status. That, to me, I think is a real problem. I don't know if there is any definitive proof that that's happening, like they're registering and then voting in large numbers where it would affect the outcome of an election. What would you say to that?
Well, a state like Virginia, which is an important state, certainly when we're looking also at the Senate and House races there, they just purged over 6,000 non-American citizens from their voter rolls. So to say that it's a one-off thing or not happening, but it is confusing. I will say that. You're right, Jason, because there are, especially in some of our urban cities, there are cities that are allowing non-citizens from other countries, even illegal migrants and others that are
non-citizens. I would say they would primarily be legal non-citizens who can vote in local elections.
They're voting in local, municipal, maybe school board elections,
yes.
Things of this nature. So we really tried through the SAVE Act.
And not to interrupt, I just find it very difficult to believe that if somebody's in the country illegally, that they're going to give their information to the government so they can be found. Like, maybe that has happened. I'm not saying it's never happened.
I just want to make sure that people can have faith and integrity in their vote and the outcome of elections. And our Constitution makes it very clear. Only American citizens can vote in these federal elections. And there are states that are, I think, taking action themselves. We felt that there was a great opportunity through this SAVE Act, and it should have been bipartisan. It actually was. I think we had 10 or 11 Democrats that voted for it. So we've done some big things, but I've also had some great accomplishments. I would love the opportunity to continue in my service and accomplishments and deliverables. And I said, making life better and easier and more affordable for the constituents of Missouri's 2nd Congressional District.
So I think one of the big issues that the Republican majority has had is the margin is so small. And it actually got smaller over time because of retirements and also an expulsion of one of your former colleagues who was then replaced by a Democrat. And because of this, I think your leadership has had to make a lot of not so great strategic concessions to, frankly, some of the more extreme elements of your caucus. I'll name names like Matt Gaetz, Paul Gosar, Marjorie Taylor Greene, people who I would say you probably disagree with a lot in not only style, but policy. Is that going to replicate itself in 2025 if, let's just say, the Republicans maintain control of the House, but it's only a 3-vote margin?
Well, I certainly hope not, because we are sent to Washington to get things done. I am not a show horse. I am a workhorse. And I am willing to reach, as I said, reach across the aisle and get things done. I've proven that both in my Foreign Affairs Committee vice chairmanship and leadership in the financial services. And I have good relations within our conference, too. But yes, we do have some renegades in the Republican conference that, may be doing certain things for clickbait and not necessarily to be representing their constituents or being a part of a team that's got a small majority. I do think small majorities are going to remain. I mean, we had a 4-seat majority, and at one point, I think in January or February, we were down to almost a 1-seat, and it was a game of bed check, pardon me, which meant who showed up for work, how many Democrats, how many Republicans, who was out, whether you can bring something to the floor. It's tough for the whip team, which I'm on, to juggle that. But divided government is difficult. But still, Republicans maintaining the majority in the House, that means we run the agenda. That means that we have those 12 key top committees and all the subcommittees underneath them and the hearings and all the markups of the legislation. I mean, deciding the path forward is important here. So the majority, however slim it might be, and I do think it will be very slim one way or another, 5 to 7 seats perhaps. I think that it's going to be in our favor. I have campaigned for a number of my colleagues across the country, and it's a part of the role that I needed to do as a leader in our party to make sure that we do grow, maintain and grow our House leadership.
I want to talk about RECA, which is the Radioactive Exposure Compensation Act. And since this is the first time I've talked with you since this article in the Kansas City Star came out a while ago, you were quoted saying, "We're just not looking to raise our deficits and debts any further than they already are, and that there would have to be legit pay fors for this." So I wasn't there, obviously, when you were talking with the Kansas City Star reporter. I don't know if you were just repeating some of the concerns that people like Speaker Mike Johnson had. And frankly, those concerns manifested themselves when he blocked RECA for those reasons. But before I talk about what happened next, can you explain your quote there?
Yeah, well, frankly, it was caught off guard. I didn't even know that there was a piece of legislation that Senator Hawley had been advancing. I was not even aware of it. So we're always in the House, especially because we're the ones where the power of the purse and the budgetary responsibilities stem from, looking to make sure that we're not spending the American taxpayer into oblivion. I mean, our debt and deficits are way too high, $34 trillion at this point in time, and we got to stop printing money. And there was a lot of things that happened when the Democrats controlled everything in terms of the so-called Inflation Reduction Act and ARPA that really were not, that spent $6 trillion that threw us into this inflation following COVID, where we spent a good deal of money to keep the economy moving. So, but the RECA bill, as it stands now, is something that I am extremely supportive of, and I have bucked our leadership on this. Now, it's my understanding that Senator Hawley is in negotiations to try and massage it and maybe pare it back. He's working with a number of the states and some of our Native American organizations and such too, to try and come up with maybe a lower number, rail it in a little bit. I have no idea. He's taking the lead on this. I support it either way, because I'm going to tell you, Missourians have been denied any kind of compensation for the suffering of the radioactive exposure that they've had. I've dealt with Westlake for years. I've never represented Coldwater Creek, and I certainly am out in St. Charles now at Weldon Springs. But I worked with Senator Blunt to get the record of decision with the EPA for Westlake, and that took nearly a decade to get done. But to the extent that we need to expand for survivors who deserve, if their U.S. government has poisoned them through this nuclear program, we need to take care of them, and I support it. So one of the things that I did to make sure we were still in a position to move RECA forward was there were many in the Senate and the House that were pushing for a clean reauthorization of RECA as it stood, which meant that Missourians would not have been included. And I did stand up on the floor, went to our leadership, and blocked that from happening. So if they're not going to include Missouri, I don't want a clean reauthorization. I want to make sure that Senator Hawley, who is taking the lead, is able to come up with a plan that everyone can get behind. I hope that he's almost there. I support it regardless, because I want to make sure that my constituents are taken care of.
Okay, I understand that, like, Republican on Republican violence is like catnip for the media, but I have to be very candid with you. After you made that quote to the Kansas City Star, Senator Hawley launched a pretty vicious social media attack against you and accused you of turning your back on radioactive waste victims, which you then sent out a tweet saying, you know, I always will support them and I support the RECA bill. But I had never seen a situation where a sitting Republican senator from Missouri had attacked a senior Republican member of Congress from Missouri. Like, should I have been? It was my reaction and surprise something that was unusual.
We didn't respond in kind to Senator Hawley. I have no quarrel with him whatsoever. We may have different styles and our approaches to how we pass legislation, how we deal with our own delegation and members on both Republicans and Democrats, but I am supportive of the legislation of RECA in whatever form he is able to get this done, and I'm committed to making sure that it doesn't move forward without Missourians included in it.
Well, let's talk about your other bailiwick, I don't know, one of those two, and that's foreign affairs.
Yes.
I think one of the other areas where you have taken a very different position than members in your party is on Ukraine funding. I know that in the latest foreign affairs bill that passed, I don't know, 4 or 5, 6 months ago, you supported continued aid to Ukraine. You even posted a photo of you and Vladimir Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, and then was pillared by a lot of people that support Donald Trump for doing that. Do you have any concerns, though, that if Donald Trump becomes president, considering he has said he wants to, like, create this quote-unquote peace deal that ends this conflict, that he is going to force Ukraine in a situation where they have to give up a lot of their land to Russia and could be vulnerable to being attacked 2, 3, 4, 5 years after that quote-unquote peace deal is cobbled together?
Well, let's go back in time certainly within the Biden-Harris administration as to how we got to this place. The world is on fire because American deterrence, American leadership on the world stage globally is void. In fact, it's not just void, it is negative. We have no deterrent factor. We've got an axis of evil that includes Russia, China, and certainly Iran. And we have seen weakness, whether it was started with pipelines that they wouldn't let go through, or whether it started with the horrific and failed pullout of Afghanistan. I mean, we all knew that we were going to leave, but Bagram Air Base was supposed to stay. There were 2,500 soldiers that were supposed to remain there. 13 of our service members were killed, and there has been very little transparency and no accountability in that regard. And this happens over and over again. And when your allies can't trust you and your enemies don't fear you and America steps back, then bad actors, authoritarians, dictators step in. And Vladimir Putin is absolutely one of them. And I think it is unconscionable that he has attacked a sovereign country of Ukraine. Now, they are not a member of NATO, but they are in the neighborhood there. And they are a sovereign country.
Would you want them to join NATO after this conflict? They can't do it now because they're currently being invaded. But like, what's your thought on
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. And
yes, you're a yes on that.
Yeah, they are on the track to be joining the EU first. And I serve on the NATO Interparliamentary Group. And yes, I believe one day, hopefully when Ukraine is safe and sovereign and rebuilt once again, they can be a part of our NATO alliance also. And in fact, we've only grown NATO. I think Putin felt that he was going to be able to fracture it. And what we did was even grow it with Sweden and Finland, which are right along the Russian border line. And they have incredible military and navy defenses. We participate in a lot of working games with them when it comes to our defense and such. So they're key. And I, as a member of the NATO Interparliamentary Group, have been working to make sure that all of our NATO allies reach their 2% of GDP in contributing to defense. This is key. And now I can say by the end of the year, we're going to have at least 2/3 there. And Sweden and Finland are above that. And many are, like Poland. But my concern about Putin is he's made it clear he won't stop with Ukraine. He's going to march on. He wants to rebuild the old USSR. And what I don't want, Jason, the reason that I have supported sending lethal aid to Ukraine is I don't want him invading a NATO country, Article 5 being triggered, and then that means we've got our boots on the ground. That means we're sending our boys into combat again. I'd rather send him bullets, not boys, okay? And that's my red line. I believe our NATO countries and partners ought to be picking up the tab for sustaining, rebuilding the government payments, humanitarian, but lethal aid into Ukraine is something that I have been very supportive of, and I am very disappointed in this administration that I believe has slow-rolled everything. We should be... I mean, we all want this war to end, Jason, but it needs to be done with overwhelming force. and some diplomacy too, but overwhelming force. I believe whether it's the ATACMS, whether it's F-16s, whatever it is, they have slow rolled this at every turn.
Well, let me go back to my question, though. President Trump has talked about like ending the war before he takes office if he wins. And again, a lot of people who support Ukraine are fearful he is going to force Ukraine to give up a lot of their territory and then make them vulnerable to be attacked again. Like, what do you think about that?
Well, I do trust that Donald Trump is going to end this war. He will. He believes in strength, and he believes in leading through strength and standing up to dictators and bullies. Don't know what he has in mind in terms of negotiating that, but again, overwhelming force and diplomacy will be a part of it. We want this war to end. I trust that Donald Trump will do so. And whatever we do, we have to put we have to defeat Putin and put Ukraine in the strongest position that they are for whatever kind of negotiation that they may be willing to enter into. They are the sovereign country that has to make this decision.
We'll talk more about Trump after this break with Congresswoman Ann Wagner.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with Congresswoman Ann Wagner. She is the 2nd District Congresswoman, which by the way, we didn't mention this. It's part of St. Charles County, part of St. Louis County, all of Franklin County, and part of Warren County. I can memorize that like on the back of my hand now. Well, let's talk about Israel, because I know you've been a supporter of aid to Israel.
Yes.
As well. I have been pretty horrified by what's happened there as somebody who is Jewish. I was horrified by what happened on October 7th. I've been horrified to see the images and read the news of Palestinian civilians being killed. I get why you would support Israel's right to militarily retaliate after October 7th. But what is the point where we have to use leverage to come to some sort of end to this violence?
Well, I think that's dependent upon Hamas and ultimately Iran. What this administration, the Biden-Harris administration, has allowed was Iran to grow and to be funded again. The maximum pressure campaign that Donald Trump had and that was imposed actually even prior to Donald Trump coming on the scene as president, worked. Iran was poor. They had no money. We had sanctions on them. They didn't have the oil revenues. This administration removed those sanctions, allowed them to sell their oil. It was reported yesterday up to $200 billion in oil revenue sales. They even gave them direct money. So remember that Iran is driving all this. Iran has proxies that fight for them most of the time, which are Hamas that brutally attacked Gaza from Gaza in 10/7, okay? 1,200 people killed in Israel. That is completely on Hamas. All those hostages taken. I've been in the region all over Jordan, Qatar, Bahrain, Egypt, obviously to Israel several times, and have worked on hostage negotiations and on ways to get help to the Palestinian people, but also to allow Israel to defend themselves. And we're hearing now today, I know that time will tell, but they have certainly been fighting Hamas, their tunnel organization through Gaza, going after their leadership. It sounds, we don't have DNA verification, that they've gotten Yahya Sinwar, who was the mastermind.
Yeah, and by the way, we're recording this on October 17th. 2024, it's 11:16 a.m. right now. This news has just kind of percolated. We don't know if it's been confirmed.
That's
yet.
Right. Yeah.
Do you think if that is true, though, that may be kind of the accelerator to end this conflict? I mean, the entire conceit of Benjamin Netanyahu's war in Gaza has been to eradicate Hamas. If they've killed the leader of Hamas and they've decimated their ability to attack again. Isn't this a good time to just basically declare victory and end this?
That is a decision that only, I believe, that Hamas, that obviously Netanyahu and Israel will make, but that's up to Hamas. Do they bring in another leader? We know that Qatar is harboring Hamas leadership that funds a lot of this the horrible atrocities that are going on. Will they send in someone new, a new leadership network, or is Qatar going to work with us to make sure that that does not happen? And so, again, every time we have been close to a hostage negotiation, to some sort of a ceasefire, Hamas has blown this up. And it's not just Hamas. We've got the Houthis that are all over the Red Sea that are based in Yemen. Again, another Iranian proxy that has completely destroyed any kind of commerce and maritime movement through the Red Sea and that Mediterranean area. It's very disturbing, and they've been in direct firefights with both Americans, the UK, certainly the Israelis. So the Israelis are getting it from all sides. They've got the Houthis in the Red Sea. You've got Hamas that has pushed in through Gaza, and then Hezbollah, what they have been, I think, most successful in of late, is taking out their leadership, and really fighting back against that coming in from Lebanon. And there are up to 4,000 Israeli boots in the ground that are trying to clear a space and push Hezbollah back up into Lebanon, so that at least 80,000 Israelis that have been moved from the north can move back into their homes. So this is key. But all of this goes back to Iran. Mm-hmm. Iran has also, for the first time ever, sent two different barrages of ballistic missiles. Last time, a couple weeks ago, it was 200 almost, ballistic missiles directly from Tehran into Israel. Thank God for the missile defense systems that we, the U.S., along with Israel, have built there.
So I want to ask you a number of election-related questions. So I've had the opportunity to talk to a number of 2nd Congressional District voters in the last week, and I'll be honest, it was an Instagram reel asking for responses. Do I think a lot of Republicans follow St. Louis Public Radio's Instagram? No. So it was a lot of Democrats and Democrat-leaning independents. So it's a small sample size. They are ready to run through the wall to vote for Kamala Harris and Amendment 3 because they are so upset over the fact that Missouri has banned most abortions, even in the case of rape and incest. And there's a zero-week window, unlike Florida, which has a six-week window or elsewhere. What do you say to people in your district who are suburban, college-educated voters that they have lost trust in Republicans because they've become so extreme on abortion?
Well, you know, I'm strongly pro-life. I will say that. I do believe that when you're dealing with the issue of life and choice, that you have to come at it from a standpoint of common sense, of compassion, and consensus. I don't agree with the laws on the books as they are presently. I have supported in my votes in Congress and beyond exceptions for rape and incest and life of the mother. But I did fight, I will tell you, for some 50 years in March to send this issue back to the states. And now that's where it's meant to be, and now the states are going to decide. It's in the hands of the voters. I hope that my fellow Missourians will join me in rejecting Amendment 3. I think they need to make sure that they are educated, well-educated on the actual wording. It's confusing. It's overly broad. What I want is for Missourians to be informed on the ballot issue. And I don't want Missouri to become what Kamala Harris wants it to become and the Democrats, which is taxpayer-funded abortion up to 40 weeks the moment that a baby is born.
Okay,
I don't want.
I brought this point up in 2022. And I've done a lot more interviewing with medical professionals and pro-choice supporters. So again, these are people that support legal abortion. But especially the medical professionals have told me they cannot think of a scenario where a woman went into a hospital or a Planned Parenthood at 40 weeks and said, oops, I changed my mind. I want an abortion. They say that that is a fantasy that is cooked up by anti-abortion opponents to basically make earlier abortions unavailable for people. What do you have to say to that?
It's legal. It would be legal in many, many states. And I don't want to see Missouri drift into that direction. I couldn't tell you what the average timeline of an abortion would be. I would hope they would always be rare. And as I said, we have to always come at this from compassion and common sense. I believe in a number of these exceptions. I just think the wording on Amendment 3 is extremely broad, and I want voters to be informed, and I don't want us to be a state like Illinois that will allow taxpayer-funded abortion potentially up to 40 weeks.
I want to talk about Donald Trump now. You voted to sustain Arizona and Pennsylvania's electoral votes, and I talked with you on January 6th. You were very critical of him. And I think that there are some voters, even Republicans, who may not like Kamala Harris. They may disagree with literally everything that she believes, but they may not want to vote for Donald Trump because they feel that his inaction on January 6th and his lack of remorse for that day, and it's also his promise to pardon January 6th people who committed crimes, they will either leave their ballot blank or they will vote third party. Or they may even vote for Kamala Harris just because of that. What message do you have for voters who think what he did on January 6th is disqualifying?
Well, I've got a strong message for voters of why they should be voting for Donald Trump instead of Kamala Harris on November 5th. Or starting on October 22nd when early voting begins.
Good point.
I want to make sure that we get that in. But they have to ask themselves this question. It's the age-old question, the Ronald Reagan question. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?
Yes.
I
have to interrupt you there. In 2020 was a miserable experience for people because of COVID. So do you mean like 5 years ago, basically?
Okay. Yeah.
Continue.
What I'm saying is were you better under the policies of Republicans and Donald Trump? Are better under the policies of Kamala Harris and Joe Biden.
I know you were making a point there, but I had to like interject there because we were literally recording a podcast in your house because of COVID. It was bad 4 years ago.
But I'm looking at the time that he has been there in terms of the Biden-Harris administration, and I'm telling you, the answer is no. Everywhere I go in this district, people are struggling to pay their bills. It's the cost of living, it's the cost of groceries, it's the cost of gas, it's inflation. Nearly 40% of Missourians are struggling on a weekly basis to pay their bills, especially their credit card bills. And this economy is the number one issue in this race in the 2nd District, I'll be honest with you. And it's inflation. They can't afford to buy a house. They can't afford to put, gasoline in their car to go on a trip. They're also concerned about the open borders. And while I say every state is a border state, that does not leave Missouri out, especially when we're talking about fentanyl. So you've got human trafficking. You've got fentanyl that has killed over 100,000 Americans and Missourians in the last year alone. You've got the cost that's involved in housing this. You've got the crime. Catch and release is a problem, and a big problem, and a big issue of why life is not better. And then there's crime. And crime in our communities has grown. And in fact, the FBI, and I find this really unconscionable by the Department of Justice and the FBI. The FBI revised its figures from last year. They've been telling Americans, and Kamala Harris has been echoing it everywhere, that violent crime went down 2.1% last year. Well, guess what? The FBI was wrong, as they are on so many things. In fact, violent crime has increased 4.5% last year. And today they had to announce that there was a net increase of 80,000 violent crimes. So crimes in the last year alone. So crime is a big issue in our communities, an issue that people care about. And then, of course, they're concerned about the fact that our world is on fire. We have this axis of evil out here. We're engaged in wars in Europe, wars in the Middle East. They're afraid about their own safety and security and that of the United States and our weakness and our deterrent factor that has disappeared. So 4 years ago, 5 years ago, whatever it is, I'm telling you, folks are not better off, and that's why they need the policies
of
Donald
Trump. And
then
the January 6th stuff, they should just cast aside and pretend never happened?
No, January 6th was a horrible day. I was there. It was an absolute horrible day. There's no doubt about it. I voted to seat the electors, as I think you know.
I do.
And more than that, I know Joe Biden won the election because I know this because he's been in the White House with Kamala Harris making our lives miserable now for the last 4 years.
I appreciate you saying that so I didn't have to ask you six or seven different times whether he won the election.
But as I
believe it or not, that's a hard question for some Republicans, but continue.
He's there. I know he won because he's there. He's there with Kamala Harris, and as I said, they have been making our life miserable for 4 years. So I am focused on November 5th, on winning back the White House, making sure that we keep our, hopefully grow our majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, and I do believe we're going to take the U.S. Senate. So I'm going to fight to make your life, as I've always said, better, easier, and more affordable. Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Well, Congresswoman, thank you so much for your time, as always. And we had Ray Hartman, the Democratic candidate, on as well. And I'm very happy that 2nd District voters can listen to both of these interviews and make an informed decision. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. You can read all of our coverage of the 2024 election at stlpr.org. And Congresswoman, how could people find out more about your campaign on the World Wide Web?
Well, they can go to annwagner.com. But I also have to say, you know, I'd like to have a word about my Democrat opponent, if you don't mind.
Sure. And if you have time, I'm willing to give it to you. Because he definitely attacked you on multiple levels.
Well,
but continue.
You know, I have to tell you, I consider him to be a dishonest liberal Democrat. He is not running a serious campaign in any way, shape, or form. And what he is doing, Jason, is bilking his donors. He is paying himself a salary of $5,000 a month plus some pretty exorbitant expenses. It adds up to some $70,000 a year salary is what he is doing.
Which is allowed under FEC guidelines. I want to make it clear.
But I have never come across a candidate that has ever done that and paid themselves and not, again, lining his pocket with donor money that is supposed to be spent on voter contact. The only voter contact that we can see from his FEC filings are a few billboard purchases and maybe some yard signs. I mean, I've got 9 campaign mailers that are going out. We're not going door to door. We're making phone calls. I've got radio ads. We're streaming commercials and ads on in the streaming services. We're emailing. We're calling. We're doing rallies. We're going to businesses. We're meeting people where they are. And my opponent is doing nothing but bilking his donors and has done this as a way of life to line his pockets, and it's dishonest. He's liberal as the day is long, and he is not a serious candidate. I have never had a candidate that I've run against ever that has taken this kind of approach, not putting their money and that of their donors that believe in them into actually touching voters and talking about issues, doing it to line his pocket. Upwards of $70,000. It's outrageous.
Well, he has his response to that because I asked him about it. So you can have the attack and the response by listening to both episodes. Congresswoman, thank you again for your time.
You bet. My pleasure, Jason.
So long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.